what the U.S. has been doing in all this time. They could have easily, as many have pointed out, pushed and made a ceasefire happen. That has not occurred. And now we have Trump coming in 3 weeks. He said if the hostages are not released by Inauguration Day, January 20th, all hell is going to break out. What do you imagine might happen then?
Oh, I mean, it needs to stop is the number one point. But there is absolutely no dignity left. And that's what I mean when I say humanity has ended. Feroz is talking about malnourishment. Absolutely. Every single child has some sort of hypopigmentation. And, you and I both know as physicians, that's the number one sign of acute malnourishment. Children are displaying these signs all the time. And then when we talk about dignity, imagine, this population was not poor to begin with. The majority of people were well-to-do. They had professions like you and I do. They had education, 98% literacy rate there. Overnight, their lives were changed. You imagine living in a tent that's made out of scraps in cold weather with about 20 other people. On so many levels, that's a violation of a person's dignity and basic human needs. I spoke to so many people, so many women especially, that commented on, there's no menstrual pads.
I'm so sorry, Dr. Mimi Sayed. We're going to have to end it there. American emergency medicine physician who just left Gaza, and Dr. Feroz Sidva, trauma surgeon who volunteered in Gaza. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Thank you so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Are you ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, going now until December 31st. You can double your donation by donating today and have your contribution match dollar for dollar up to $20,000.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is KBOO News in Review. I'm your news director, Althea Billings. From now until the new year, KBOO News will be looking back at some of our favorite and most impactful stories from 2024. On this episode, we're going to be looking back at some of our interviews with the folks at Street Roots, another nonprofit news organization in Portland. Before we do, we want to remind you that KBOO is in our Catalog of Connections end-of-year drive. Now is a perfect time to support KBOO with a donation. We're here with the news, views, and music you rely on, and we can't do it without your support. Consider donating online at kboo.fm/give. You can text the word KBOO to 44321, or you can mail us a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. If you're a regular news listener, definitely let us know. Okay, on to the show. This Street Roots interview comes from July, just after the Supreme Court handed down its landmark decision in Grants Pass v. Johnson. You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest story for the paper. It's called Supreme Court Rules Arresting, Citing People for Not Having Shelter is Constitutional. Supreme Court overturns ruling in Oregon case, decides criminalizing homeless residents for sleeping outside isn't cruel or unusual. Hey, Jeremiah, thanks for being here.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
So the Supreme Court decision in Grants Pass v. Johnson is the talk of the town, and you were actually there at the Supreme Court in D.C. when this case was being heard, so I'm eager to hear your thoughts on all of this. Let's break it down. What did the Supreme Court decide on Friday?
Yeah, so essentially the Supreme Court decided that it is okay for cities to level civil and criminal penalties against people who have no other place to go. A bit more hyperbolic version of that same statement is that it's punishing people because they have no other place to go. That's not so far off. I mean, this decision does really impact the way that cities are expected to respond to homelessness in their communities. And the court essentially ruled that the Ninth Circuit court decision from a couple of years ago went too far in saying that Grants Pass ordinances leveling these penalties against people who are homeless violated the Eighth Amendment. So the court disagreed. They overturned that. And generally in the Ninth Circuit now, cities are able to punish people for their poverty.
So this was a 6-3 ruling, the conservative justices having the majority there. What was their reasoning? How did they support this decision that they made?
To some extent, this just comes back to a states' rights thing, as you might expect. Gorsuch wrote the opinion of the court and essentially just said that the Constitution's Eighth Amendment serves many important functions, but it does not authorize federal judges to wrest those rights and responsibilities from the American people. They argue, since Grants Pass is not punishing the status of being homeless, but rather the conduct associated with homelessness, that's something that Grants Pass gets to decide, and it's something that they say other jurisdictions can decide to do or not do if they choose to not punish people. But that's something that's better left to policymakers rather than the court.
What was the response in the dissent from the other three justices?
Well, I think the most powerful one is like really quite simple, which is Justice Sotomayor saying that sleeping is an essential human function and not a crime. Grants Pass had made it literally impossible for people who don't have another place to go to exist within the city limits or use a blanket to cover themselves, in the cold. And essentially it came down to that punishing, people who don't have a home is sort of the point here. Grants Pass does not punish babies. That's something that Sotomayor said in oral arguments too. Like, Grants Pass doesn't punish babies who have a blanket over them when they're in the parks. It literally only punishes homeless people. So punishing on housing status is something that seems to be cruel and unusual, at least to Kagan and Brown Jackson and Sotomayor, but the other three justices decided otherwise.
This case didn't even reach some of the questions before it, including whether the Grants Pass ordinances violate the excessive fines clause or the due process clause. Can you touch on that aspect? Where does that leave things if they didn't reach those issues?
The original case was filed in 2018, just a few weeks after the Martin v. Boise decision came down. It's worth noting the court effectively reversed Martin v. Boise too, which says that people can't be punished if there isn't adequate shelter for them within those city limits. So that original case had actually multiple complaints. The one that the court actually addressed was the cruel and unusual punishments clause of the Eighth Amendment, but it actually didn't say anything about the Due Process Clause, Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, and the Excessive Fines Clause. So this complaint was saying that since Grants Pass is handing out these fines of $295, which go up to $537, they kick people out of parks. If people are kicked out of parks and they are found there, even though they have no other place to go, they can receive a $1,250 fine. That's the excessive fines argument. And also, by the time people are actually kicked out of a park, whether or not they have due process is, I guess it's not much of an open question, but like, if people are kicked out of parks, they've already been punished. And so that's the argument of this case. The court didn't decide on any of that stuff. So there may be still some future litigation here based on, you know, other parts of the Constitution.
You mentioned this earlier, that the argument that was being presented to the court, that this kind of these laws that Grants Pass had in place could not be constitutional, was this issue of status versus conduct, which dates back to other case law that goes back to the 60s, having to do with someone who was addicted to drugs, and could they be punished just because they're addicted to drugs. Now, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion kind of questioning that, if I understand rightly. Can you explain sort of what the consequence of that is?
Yeah, just to reiterate that, this Grants Pass case is really rooted in this argument. Robinson has cited over and over again. It's rooted in this argument that homelessness is a status, something a person cannot avoid. And that is a really important precedent, because it says that if you can't punish a person based on status, then a person is protected from things that they cannot help. In the courtroom, there was a bit of a discussion about this, and Thomas was really the only one who seemed keen on the idea of overturning Robinson. A few other people, Amy Coney Barrett, said, "I'm not suggesting we overturn Robinson explicitly." But yeah, Thomas did decide, he doesn't have to do this, but he issued this concurring opinion saying that he believed Robinson is wrongly decided and that a future case could be brought that would challenge that. The implications of that are pretty broad. The idea that you could punish somebody based on something that they can't help is pretty terrifying. Of course, there are like protected classes in the United States based on race, sex, sexual preference and stuff. So for now, that might be safe, but that certainly seems like one of the pillars that might fall first if they were going to start punishing people based on the way that they're born.
Well, and this case comes out of Oregon, and immediately the question is, how does that impact us here at home now that this court case has been decided at the highest level?
The Oregon legislature, it went into effect in July 2023, but the Oregon legislature passed ORS 195-530, which required, it effectively codified Martin v. Boise. So it requires city ordinances regulating survival activities to be objectively reasonable with regard to people experiencing homelessness. So things aren't expected to change in Oregon very quickly because there is this law that technically protects people. That even is cited in these Supreme Court documents. But there has been a bit of a backlash to that because elected politicians have not been historically great at doing the things necessary for resolving the homelessness crisis. They've instead opted to blame essentially anyone else. It was judges for a while. It was lawyers for a while. You know, the Ninth Circuit Court. And now it's this pesky little law that protects homeless residents from being punished for being homeless. So it's expected to kind of not change here on a legal basis. But at the same time, a court saying that it's not cruel and unusual to punish people in poverty certainly opens up a lot of doors for harassment, be it from neighbors, some park watch groups that exist in Grants Pass or the police, you know. There's kind of a real world implication there versus the legal reality.
What have elected officials around Oregon been saying in response to this ruling?
There's been a not very broad window of responses here, but you know, kind of on the further right, more conservative, the House Republicans from the Oregon legislature issued a statement saying that we need to go after ORS 195-530 because that's the thing that's standing in the way, that doesn't give law enforcement the tools that it needs. You know, the House leader said that this is what conservative governance looks like. And then here in Portland, Commissioner Renee Gonzalez is saying that the dark days of the Ninth Circuit's decision, you know, are finally over. And he, you know, also believes that they need to go after that law. I will say, Governor Kotek, you know, this was passed when she was the Speaker of the House, that state law. And she issued a statement saying that she's more focused on affordable housing, the things that actually work to resolve homelessness. It was a bit of a tepid response. She did not say she would veto any legislation that would, you know, if they passed something that actually challenged that state law or overturned that state law. So it's a bit up in the air. And, you know, it kind of ranges from, you know, on one side, you know, conservatives really saying we need to go after this law, and then Democrats sort of not saying anything about the law.
What is being said at the Multnomah County level?
Yeah, Jessica Vega Peterson essentially said, you know, similar thing, that there's a lot of work to do to solve homelessness. And, you know, some of the Democrats seem to understand that regardless of punishing people, the housing crisis needs to be solved if homelessness is going to be solved. So that was, again, her focus, very similar to Governor Kotek's. And, you know, that comes in the context of the city and the state. You know, speaking of the city, Mayor Wheeler released one that said that he supported a robust discussion in the legislature about whether or not cities have the tools that they need to solve this. So this is all in the context of a new camping ban in the city and a new intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County and the city. So, you know, it remains to be seen, but at least for now, there's a state law that protects people.
I want to also ask about Grants Pass, which is the city that is at the center of this whole issue. You spent some time there in your reporting as well. What does this mean for Grants Pass itself?
Grants Pass is under the same state law as everyone else. So, and that is essentially under the decision, a little bit more vague version of the Martin v. Boise decision. So, you know, they know. I talked to Cassie Leach, who runs the Mint navigation team that goes into parks and helps people, takes people to appointments, offers healthcare to people who don't have access to it otherwise. And she told me that, you know, she told me a few months ago that there was sort of a alignment that was happening where people were starting to recognize that they have to solve this crisis. They have to have emergency shelter for people, that which they have historically not had, and they have to offer resources to people, and they need to build more affordable housing. So she is quite disappointed, but is at the center of a lot of these discussions and seems to have some optimism. That's something that I actually get from, you know, across the country. I think it's a catalyzing moment for people who understand what it takes to resolve homelessness, and those things are somewhat clear to some people and somewhat less clear to others, but regardless, you know, a lot of people are doing the work to actually resolve this thing in the long run.
What do you hope readers and listeners take away from this story?
This is a really difficult decision to stomach. People on all sides of this issue want to see homelessness go away. Particularly visible homelessness is something that a lot of people are up in arms about. Criminalizing people who don't have other options doesn't work. It won't work in the future. And doing the actual work of getting people into housing, this is an affordable housing crisis. We had a coronavirus pandemic in 2020 that, you know, really made a lot of difficult things for a lot of different people. And, you know, this is a result of that stuff, and we know what it takes to resolve it. Decisions like this do nothing but exacerbate the issue. And we'll probably wake up in a few years and be a little bit disappointed about how much worse things have gotten because of this ruling.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest story. It's called Supreme Court Rules Arresting, Citing People for Not Having Shelter is Constitutional. More information on that story is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. You are listening to KBOO News in Review. I'm your news director, Althea Billings. From now until the new year, we'll be taking a look back at some of our favorite and most impactful stories from 2024. Remember, you can support our end-of-year membership drive anytime during this show. Go online to kboo.fm/give to make a donation. Thank you. This next interview with Street Roots comes from August. You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, and Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about their new three-part story, The Great Portland Crime Ripple. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So let's start in part one of your coverage, which is titled The Facts of the Matter. This piece examines, let's say, the crime wave that wasn't. We'll talk about what the data shows about the crime wave or lack thereof, but I want to get up to speed on the narrative around crime in Portland. What has that been like over the past 4 years?
Well, I think, you know, kind of the prevailing narrative in the public is, and I think from city officials as well, is that crime is going up, right? I think that there is, there are a lot of concerns about the frequency of crime, the severity of crime in Portland. And, you know, I think just kind of this general sense that Portland has become a very dangerous place and is experiencing a really significant surge in crime.
Well, your piece interrogates that. What are some of the ways to analyze a crime wave?
Yeah, that's, I think a much more complex question than we maybe initially realized when we first set out to do this story. But, you know, there are a number of data sources that you can look at. We looked at pretty much everything that was available to us, including reported crimes data from PBB, which kind of the only data source we looked at that isn't just raw data. That's something that, you know, the police bureau kind of compiles and analyzes themselves. We looked at the number of calls, both emergency and non-emergency, resulting in police dispatch. We looked at arrests. We looked at the total volume of calls to the Bureau of Emergency Communications and, you know, did our best to really address that question of whether or not crime is going up in Portland over the last 4 years.
What were some of your findings?
You know, I think there are some things that are going to be really surprising to people, like the arrest, the number of arrests per year on average has gone down by about 44% over the last 4 years, which very, very much so kind of outpaces any decrease in police officers or anything like that. The number of calls to the Bureau of Emergency Communications, both emergency and non-emergency, resulting in police dispatch have gone down about 10 to 11% over the last 4 years. You know, things like shoplifting arrests have gone down over 67% over the last 4 years. And I think really, you know, the only data source we found that really indicated that there's been any really notable increase in crime overall is PPB's reported crime statistics, which are, you know, they include unverified reports of crime. And even then, the less than 10% increase over the last 4 years is very, very much so largely attributed to a really sharp increase in the reports of vandalism, as well as a lot more reports of vehicle thefts. Well, I mean, I say a lot, but it's, you know, around 1,200. So yeah, it's, I would say that the data indicates there has not been a massive crime wave in Portland.
To dig into that a little bit further, you devote a whole section to talking about the calls and the narrative around the Bureau of Emergency Communications, and a certain city commissioner, Renee Gonzalez, had a claim that was out there that the Bureau of Emergency Communications was being overwhelmed because of a crime wave. What were you able to figure out about what was really going on there?
Right. This is sort of a common thing where people can sort of cherry pick, you know, certain aspects of, you know, how crime is reported and how internal agencies report that data to sort of fit a narrative. So Commissioner Gonzalez, as you mentioned, he's the commissioner who was in charge of the BOEC until July 1st. And, you know, he's mentioned in the press, to the television news particularly, saying that the dispatchers experienced a 35% increase in workload in the first 6 months of 2023 compared to the first 6 months of 2018. So there's kind of the thing behind that where it's like, why 2023 and 2018 is sort of random. And it does, that would support the idea, you know, without any further criticism that, we're in this massive crime wave and that's why all of these calls are going up. He blames, you know, crime, heavy drug use, lack of collective public health continues to create these roadblocks. There's sort of this mixture of fact and fiction there. When you compare those, 2018 to 2023, the staffing was 13% lower in 2023, but the average call volume was just 2% higher. So it is true that those calls, increased by 18%, but there's no real data supporting the claim that it's crime-related and that it went up, 35% within that time frame. He's made other similar arguments, particularly to the television news and sort of cherry-picked data, saying, but really the call volume is 6% higher in the first 6 months of 2023 compared to 2019. So this is kind of like some of the point of our research and article here is that just cherry picking, one of the people that we talked to, a PSU researcher, Melissa Thompson, was saying, like, anytime you kind of see these short term cherry picked data points, you should have a critical eye for that.
There's a rather striking quote from this first article from PSU sociology professor Aaron Roussel, who says, quote, "I can't emphasize this enough, that the word crime doesn't describe anything," end quote. Help me break this down. What does Roussel mean here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is kind of somewhat of a philosophical question that we ran into, which, is can be kind of tough to square with a story. I mean, three stories that are really mostly about data. But I think the argument that we got from two of the academics we spoke to is that, crime itself is kind of this shaky concept where, I think the public generally understands it as this approximation of harm being done in a community. But there's also kind of a lot of things that take place that aren't considered to be a crime, but I think you could absolutely argue they harm somebody. And I think also the flip side of that is there are a lot of things that are considered criminal that probably, aren't really affecting kind of the moral fabric of society. So, crime statistics themselves are produced, maintained, and published by police largely, who themselves do have, an interest often in those statistics reflecting one narrative or another. Whether or not, that's happening in this case, I think there's no evidence for that. I think just in general, experts we spoke to kind of were encouraging a little bit more scrutiny for statistics like this. And I think what the evidence does show is that the narratives that we've been getting from police and from officials are not supported by their data.
Well, the second part of your coverage of the Great Portland Crime Ripple is called Budgets and Bodies. This looks at the Portland Police Bureau's budget, staffing, and reputation and stacks that up against this lack of a crime wave. What are some of the things to know about the police's relationship to crime?
One of the things that we talked about with Chris Henning, who's a criminology professor at Portland State, was this kind of idea of proactive policing versus reactive policing. And there's really no consensus from academia on this, although since the 70s, it has been a bit unpopular to talk about proactive policing, in part because that is, sort of a broader umbrella term for, things like stop and frisk policies. That is a kind of, pulling people over for having broken taillights and then searching for weapons or drugs, things that kind of come out of a much smaller offense. Those are exactly the things that lead to racial disparities in policing. And so proactive policing is something that the public and sort of, you know, through this sort of recent revelation after the police officer murdered George Floyd, people in communities across America have really tried to get away from proactive policing by recognizing that that the outcomes are not particularly great for certain demographics. There, the argument from Henning, again, the professor, is that may be some kind of trade-off, because according to him, there is evidence that proactive policing can help stop crime before it happens. The other version of this is this reactive policing, which is essentially just responding to calls, whether that's somebody coming up to a police officer on the street and saying, hey, I saw somebody over here, this is what's happening, or something, you know, like dispatch calls. Oregon, Portland, and sort of nationally has kind of turned toward reactive policing instead. And so it kind of fits the police narrative to say that the crime is way up because A, people don't like us, B, we don't have the budgets, and so we're not able to go out and stop crime before it happens, and that's why you see this big crime wave. Again, our reporting doesn't demonstrate any sort of significant crime wave at all. And also, the idea of the police budgets, you know, is another piece of that. There may be an interest from police departments to get money to continue doing their practices. The police budget now, again, I don't know how many times you can say this, the Portland Police Bureau was never defunded. It's been up from about $208 million in 2016 to $295 million this year. And, you know, and then policing, the actual police officer rates appears to have very little to do with their budget. So their own kind of, whether if they have staffing issues, another thing that kind of comes up frequently, maybe sort of an internal HR thing for them to deal with, but it is not based on the fact that they don't have enough money. There was a brief dip, just to be clear, right around in 2020, and that was consistent with